Chapter 11. Dwarf children of science. Nature, that stores this priceless boon, seems to shrink from conceding it to man. The invisible tribes that abhor him oppose themselves to the gain that might give them a master. The duller of those who were the life-seekers of old would have told you how some chance, trivial, unlooked for, foiled their grand hope at the very point of fruition. Some doltish mistake, some improvident oversight, a defect in the sulfur, a wild overflow in the quicksilver, or a flaw in the bellows, or a pupil who failed to replenish the fuel, by falling asleep by the furnace. The invisible foes seldom vouchsafe to make themselves visible, where they can frustrate the bungler as they mock at his toils from their ambush. But the mightier adventurers, equally foiled in despite of their patience and skill, would have said, "Not with us rests the fault. We neglected no caution, we failed from no oversight." But out from the cauldron dread faces arose, and the specters or demons dismayed and baffled us. Apostrophe such, then, is the danger which seems so appalling to a son of the East, as it seemed to a seer in the dark age of Europe. But we can deride all its threats, you and one. For myself, I own frankly I take all the safety that the charms and resources of magic bestow. You, for your safety, have the cultured and disciplined reason which reduces all fantasies to nervous impressions. And I rely on the courage of one who has questioned, unquailing, the luminous shadow, and wrested from the hand of the magician himself the wand which concentered the wonders of will. To this strange and long discourse I listened without interruption, and now quietly answered. I do not merit the trust you affect in my courage, but I am now on my guard against the cheats of the fancy, and the fumes of a vapor can scarcely bewilder the brain in the open air of this mountain land. I believe in no races like those which you tell me lie viewless in space, as do gases. I believe not in magic. I ask not its aids, and I dread not its terrors. For the rest, I am confident of one mournful courage, the courage that comes from despair. I submit to your guidance, whatever it be, as a sufferer whom college is doomed to the grave, submits to the quack who says, "Take my specific and live." Apostrophe, apostrophe, my life is not in itself. My life lives in another. You and I are both brave from despair. You would turn death from yourself, I would turn death from one I love more than myself. Both know how little aid we can win from the colleges, and both, therefore, turn to the promises most audaciously cheering. Dervish or magician, alchemist or phantom, what care you and I? And if they fail us, what then? They cannot fail us more than the colleges do. The gold has been gained with an easy labor. I knew where to seek for it, whether under the turf or in the bed of the creek. But Margrove's eyes, hungrily gazing round every spot from which the ore was disburied, could not detect the substance of which he alone knew the outward appearance. I had begun to believe that, even in the description given to him of this material, he had been credulously duped, and that no such material existed, when, coming back from the bed of the watercourse, I saw a faint, yellow gleam amidst the roots of a giant parasite plant, the leaves and blossoms of which climbed up the sides of the cave with its antediluvian relics. The gleam was the gleam of gold, and on removing the loose earth round the roots of the plant, we came on no, I will not, I dare not, describe it. The gold digger would cast it aside. The naturalist would pause not to heed it. And did I describe it, and chemistry deign to subject it to analysis, could chemistry alone detach or discover its boasted virtues? Its particles, indeed, are very minute, not seeming readily to crystallize with each other, each in itself of uniform shape and size, spherical as the egg which contains the germ of life, and small as the egg from which the life of an insect may quicken. But Margrove's keen eye caught sight of the atoms upcast by the light of the moon. He exclaimed to me, "Found! I shall live!" And then, as he gathered up the grains with tremulous hands, he called out to the veiled woman, hitherto still seated motionless on the crag. At his word she rose and went to the place hard by, where the fuel was piled, busying herself there. I had no leisure to heed her. I continued my search in the soft and yielding soil that time and the decay of vegetable life had accumulated over the pre-Adamite strata on which the arch of the cave rested its mighty keystone. When we had collected of these particles about thrice as much as a man might hold in his hand, we seemed to have exhausted their bed. We continued still to find gold, but no more of the delicate substance to which, in our sight, gold was as dross. Enough, then, said Margrove, reluctantly desisting. What we have gained already will suffice for a life thrice, as long as legend attributes to Aaron. I shall live through the centuries. Forget not that I claim my share. Your share yours. True, your half of my life. It is true. He paused with a low, ironical, malignant laugh, and then added, as he rose and turned away, but the work is yet to be done. While we had thus labored and found, Aisha had placed the fuel, where the moonlight fell fullest on the sward of the table and a part of it already piled as for a fire, the rest of it heaped confusedly close at hand, and by the pile she had placed the coffer. And, there she stood, her arms folded under her mantle, her dark image seeming darker still as the moonlight whitened all the ground from which the image rose motionless. Margrove opened his coffer, the veiled woman did not aid him, and I watched in silence, while he as silently made his weird, and wizard-like preparations. On the ground a white circle was traced by a small rod, tipped apparently with sponge saturated with some combustible naphtha-like fluid, so that a pale, lambent flame followed the course of the rod as Margrove guided it, burning up the herbage over which it played, and leaving a distinct ring, like that which, in our lovely native fable talk, we call the fairy's ring, but yet more visible, because marked in phosphorescent light. On the ring thus formed were placed 12 small lamps, fed with the fluid from the same vessel, and lighted by the same rod. The light emitted by the lamps was more vivid and brilliant than that which circled round the ring. Within the circumference, and immediately round the woodpile, Margrove traced certain geometrical figures, in which not without a shudder, that I overcame at once by a strong effort of will in murmuring to myself the name of Lillian I recognized the interlaced triangles which my own hand, in the spell enforced on the sleepwalker, had described on the floor of the wizard's pavilion. The figures were traced like the circle, in flame, and at the point of each triangle, 4 in number, was placed a lamp, brilliant as those on the ring. This task performed, the cauldron, based on an iron tripod, was placed on the woodpile. And then the woman, before inactive and unheeding, slowly advanced, knelt by the pile and lighted it. The dry wood crackled and the flame burst forth, licking the rims of the cauldron with tongues of fire. Margrove flung into the cauldron the particles we had collected, poured over them first a liquid, colorless as water, from the largest of the vessels drawn from his coffer, and then, more sparingly, drops from small crystal phials, like the phials I had seen in the hand of Philip Derville. Having surmounted my first impulse of awe, I watched these proceedings, curious yet disdainful, as one who watches the mummeries of an enchanter on the stage. If, thought I, these are but artful devices to inebriate and fool my own imagination, my imagination is on its guard, and reason shall not, this time, sleep at her post. And now, said Margrove, I consign to you the easy task by which you are to merit your share of the elixir. It is my task to feed and replenish the cauldron. It is Aisha's to feed the fire, which must not for a moment relax in its measured and steady heat. Your task is the lightest of all. It is but to renew from this vessel the fluid that burns in the lamps and on the ring. Observe, the contents of the vessel must be thriftily husbanded. There is enough, but not more than enough, to sustain the light in the lamps, on the lines traced round the cauldron, and on the farther ring, for 6 hours. The compounds dissolved in this fluid are scarce only obtainable in the east, and even in the east months might have passed, before I could have increased my supply. I had no months to waste. replenished and the light only when it begins to flicker or fade. Take heed, above all, that no part of the outer ring, no, not an inch, and no lamp of the 12, that are to its zodiac-like stars, fade for one moment in darkness. I took the crystal vessel from his hand. The vessel is small, said I, and what is yet left of its contents is but scanty. Whether its drops suffice to replenish the lights I cannot guess. I can but obey your instructions. But, more important by far than the light to the lamps and the circle, which in Asia or Africa might scare away the wild beasts unknown to this land, more important than light to a lamp, is the strength to your frame, weak magician. What will support you through 6 weary hours of night watch? Hope, answered Margrove, with a ray of his old dazzling style. Hope. I shall live through the centuries. One hour passed away. The faggots under the cauldron burned clear in the sullen, sultry air. The materials within began to seethe, and their color, at first dull and turbid, changed into a pale rose hue. From time to time the veiled woman replenished the fire, after she had done so, reseating herself close by the pyre, with her head bowed over her knees, and her face hid under her veil. The lights in the lamps, and along the ring and the triangles now began to pale. I resupplied their nutriment from the crystal vessel. As yet nothing strange startled my eye, or my ear beyond the rim of the circle, nothing audible, save, at a distance, the musical wheel-like click of the locusts, and, farther still, in the forest, the howl of the wild dogs that never bark. Nothing visible, but the trees and the mountain range girding the plain silvered by the moon, and the arch of the cavern, the flush of wild blooms on its sides, and the gleam of dry bones on its floor, where the moonlight shot into the gloom. The second hour passed like the first. I had taken my stand by the side of Margrove, watching with him the process at work in the cauldron, when I felt the ground slightly vibrate beneath my feet, and looking up, it seemed as if all the plains beyond the circle were heaving like the swell of the sea, and as if in the air itself there was a perceptible tremor. I placed my hand on Margrove's shoulder and whispered, "To me earth and air seem to vibrate. Do they seem to vibrate to you?" "I know not, I care not," he answered impetuously. "The essence is bursting the shell that confined it. Here are my air and my earth. Trouble me not. Look to the circle, feed the lamps if they fail." I passed by the veiled woman as I walked toward a place in the ring in which the flame was waning dim, and I whispered to her the same question which I had whispered to Margrove. She looked slowly around and answered, "So is it before the invisible make themselves visible. Did I not bid him forbear?" Her head again drooped on her breast, and her watch was again fixed on the fire. I advanced to the circle and stooped to replenish the light where it waned. As I did so, on my arm, which stretched somewhat beyond the line of the ring, I felt a shock like that of electricity. The arm fell to my side numbed and nerveless, and from my hand dropped, but within the ring, the vessel that contained the fluid. Recovering my surprise or my stun, hastily with the other hand I caught up the vessel, but some of the scanty liquid was already spilled on the sword, and I saw with a thrill of dismay, that contrasted indeed the tranquil indifference with which I had first undertaken my charge, how small a supply was now left. I went back to Margrove, and told him of the shock, and of its consequence in the waste of the liquid. "Beware," said he, "that not a motion of the arm, not an inch of the foot, pass the verge of the ring, and if the fluid be thus unhappily stinted, reserve all that is left for the protecting circle and the 12 outer lamps. See how the grand work advances, how the hues in the cauldron are glowing blood red through the film on the surface." And now 4 hours of the 6 were gone. My arm had gradually recovered its strength. Neither the ring nor the lamps had again required replenishing. Perhaps their light was exhausted less quickly, as it was no longer to be exposed to the rays of the intense Australian moon. Clouds had gathered over the sky, and though the moon gleamed at times, in the gaps that they left in blue air, her beam was more hazy and dulled. The locusts no longer were heard in the grass, nor the howl of the dogs in the forest. Out of the circle, the stillness was profound. And about this time I saw distinctly in the distance a vast eye. It drew nearer and nearer, seeming to move from the ground at the height of some lofty giant. Its gaze riveted mine. My blood curdled in the blaze from its angry ball. And now as it advanced larger and larger, other eyes, as if of giants in its train, grew out from the space in its rear numbers on numbers, like the spearheads of some eastern army, seen afar by pale warders of battlements doomed to the dust. My voice long refused an utterance to my awe. At length it burst forth shrill and loud. Look, look! Those terrible eyes! Legions on legions! And hark! That tramp of numberless feet! They are not seen, but the hollows of earth echo the sound of their march. Margrove, more than ever intent on the cauldron, in which, from time to time, he kept dropping powders or essences drawn forth from his coffer, looked up, defyingly, fiercely. Ye come, he said in a low mutter, his once mighty voice sounding hollow and laboring, but fearless and firm, ye come not to conquer, vain rebels, ye whose dark chief I struck down at my feet in the tomb, where my spell had raised up the ghost of your first human master, the Chaldee. Earth and air have their armies still faithful to me, and still I remember the war song that summons them up to confront you. Ayesha, Ayesha, recall the wild troth that we pledged among the roses. Recall the dread bond by which we united our sway over hosts, that yet own thee as queen, though my scepter is broken, my diadem reft from my brows. The veiled woman rose at this adjuration. Her veil now was withdrawn, and the blaze of the fire between Margrove and herself flushed, as with the rosy bloom of youth, the grand beauty of her softened face. It was seen, detached, as it were, from her dark-mantled form. Seen through the mist of the vapors which rose from the cauldron, framing it round like the clouds that are yieldingly pierced by the light of the evening star. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.